Welcome to Ken Lovren's Kansas City. Today we are blessed to be visited by one of the select few who can really be called Kansas City entertainment royalty, and that is Mr. Lonnie McFadden. Lonnie's toured the world under his name, with his brother Ronald McFadden in their entertainment supergroup, the McFadden Brothers. Lonnie's also a longtime fixture on the Kansas City scene. I look forward to hearing what Lonnie's got going on right now. Well, this is Ken Lovren, and I am fortunate enough to be sitting here with one of Kansas City's premier entertainers, Mr. Lonnie McFadden. Lonnie, welcome.
Wow. Thank you. Thanks, Ken.
So glad to have you here, and you've got a lot of exciting things going on. One of the things we're going to focus on today is your new release, Lonnie McFadden Live at Green Lady Lounge. Tell me a little bit about that.
Wow. Well, that is wow. This CD is really taking on a life of its own. Even me being sitting here with you. I mean, we've been knowing each other forever, and now I'm finally getting a chance to do the radio show with you. And you know, you've played gigs with Ronald and I for years, so it's like this CD is reintroducing me to everybody in a new kind of way, and I'm loving it, man. I got all these fiery young musicians on the CD, and they're keeping me from appearing to be too old. I am over 30, so let's get that out of the way.
In case there was any confusion about that.
In case there's any confusion, exactly.
Some of those musicians are a little younger, but you're over 30. Some of them might be under.
Yeah, they are.
Let's go ahead and play a track off this. Okay. Let's play this In the Club track. And that's right. One you wrote with a young musician. Maybe tell us a little bit about
Tyree,
that.
Tyree, man, this kid, it's amazing. I was put in a position a little over a year ago where I had to replace the drummer. As you know, you played gigs with me and Ronald throughout the years, and Donovan was there, man. So Donovan,
he was the man.
Oh, he's been such a loyal, not only a great musician with me and what I've tried to do, but he was such a good friend, and he just was always there. So how do you replace that? And it's no way to replace it. All you can do is pick up from now and try to move forward. And in doing so, I had the opportunity to meet and perform with a lot of really great young drum. Ken, you and I have talked, there's so many great musicians around here now, and I've met a few of them finally, and it's awesome to me. And what happened is I got reintroduced to Tyree. I met him when he's like 15 years old. And then I heard him about 4 years ago, three or four years ago, at a dedication to a gentleman in the inner city. He was with the band. He was the youngest one in the band, but he was the standout member of the band. And I never forgot that. So when I was looking for a drummer, he's one of the people that I had coming and playing my gigs that I had to fill. And we just connected. I mean, I don't know if it's because we have the same background. I don't know. We just connected on a lot of levels. And now, let's fast forward to he's performing with me. Other than Mark Lowry, he's the only musician that was way younger than me that just used to come over to my house and hang out. Tyree would call me and say, "Hey, Lonnie, what are you doing?" I'm like, "Nothing." He said, "Hey, well, I want to come over and we practice." So me and him, it was like the old days of when I was a teenager and had a band. It's like me and Tyree would sit down and listen to music and talk about music and talk about why different drummers were doing things. And it's like, I found myself in a mentoring situation that felt good, because after me meeting all these people and learning all this stuff, here's a young guy that's never been around it, and I get a chance to share some of the things I learned from being on the road and being around people like Jeff Tane Watts and all these other great drummers and that I've seen and played on the same bandstand with. And so we got real close. And now in the middle of me thinking I'm turning him on to some drummer concepts, we started talking about my last CD, and he asked me how I did it, and I told him what I was doing, and he said, "Well, you can do a whole lot more with your computer program than you're doing." So he took me downstairs. I have a studio at my house, and we went to the studio, and he started showing me how to navigate GarageBand. In the midst of him showing me how to use it, he said, "Okay, for instance, Lonnie, if I put a bass line here, now what do you want to do? And then I said, well, I put some chords like this. And so he switched over to a different track and he said, okay, now put down something on the horn. And so in the meantime, he's just showing me how to use it. So we just playing around with ideas, just the first thing off the top of our head. After we listened to it back, when he was showing me how to mix it, both of us were like, wow, this is not too bad.
Right, right.
And that's literally how this song came up. And it's a song that Tyree and I decided we'd just call it In the Club.
In the Club. Excellent. Well, let's hear it. This is from the new release, Lonnie McFadden Live at Green Lady Lounge, a tune composed by Lonnie McFadden and Tyree Johnson. This is In the Club.
Thank you.
in the club by Tyree Johnson and me.
We've just heard In the Club from the new release by Lonnie McFadden, live at Green Lady Lounge. And we're going to hear a lot more from that release coming up here. But we want to kind of go back a little bit here. And you've been a mainstay in the Kansas City entertainment world, you know, since I was getting out and playing gigs. I'll just say that. Since
I was
getting out playing gigs, you were already out there doing them.
Yeah, I might have been a couple of years ahead of you.
I remember going to some jazz festivals, you know, when I was kind of a young musician, and you guys would get a good slot on Kansas City Jazz Festival. I'd see the McFadden brothers.
And
I remember going to some function at the Charlie Parker Foundation, and you guys, you know, headlined some kind of thing there. I remember. But I've seen some posts by you and Ronald over the years since Facebook about some of your history, but I know you come from a very musical family, and that was, you know, a lot of you know, you got a lot of that through your family. But tell us just a little bit about your beginnings and how you really became into being an entertainer and being a musician and a tap dancer and a vocalist and everything you do.
Well, it sounds like I'm really confused, actually. And that may, well, here's basically the long and short of it was that we were always around it. I mean, my father had a lot of musician friends from back in the day. He used to perform with Count Basie and all those guys. So there were always these musicians that would come by the house. And I remember meeting a lot of his friends. I mean, we stayed next door to this guy that was a bass player back in the day. Only, so many of those guys are gone now, so I doubt if there's anybody now that would remember the name Ike Witt. But he was, like, best friends with Milt Abel. So I met Betty and Milt when I was, like, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years old, because their best friend, who was also a jazz bass player, Ike Witt, lived next door. Now, having said that, without going into a lot of the details about a bunch of musicians being at the house, we were always hearing stories, and my father's friends were all musicians, so I was always around it. We were always hearing Charlie Parker and Dinah Washington and Count Basie, all these people. And now, we grew up in a time where the hit music of the day was by the Beatles and James Brown. So that's where Ronald and I gravitated toward. But in the meantime, so you got these kids that are listening to James Brown and the Beatles, but my dad used to be a tap dancer. So he used to teach us stuff without us knowing that we were learning something. By the time we were like 5 and 6 years old, we started actually practicing. And then they got us these shiny patent leather shoes with the taps on it. And that was it. I mean, that was when you're a kid, you got these kids, these shoes that make all this noise and they're shiny. And so then my father, through his connections, now he wasn't performing anymore, but he still had these connections with different booking agents. And so it was this agency called Coleman and McLaughlin back then. They used to book a lot of high upscale events and things like that. And I'm not going to mention the time anyway, but he booked a few gigs for us to get some experience. And so the first time I ever performed and was paid for it was at the Muehlbach Hotel. I was 6 years old, and Ronald and I sing, if you could call it that. I mean, we did this song, "Hey, Look Me Over, Lend Me an Ear, Fresh." I mean, and it's like, my dad, he was all about the old vaudeville stuff. So we did that. And so you got these two kids that kind of can tap dance, and they singing these little cutesy songs, but my father could hit. My dad was the real deal. And so we were cute, and he was an actual hoofer. He was bringing it. And so that was my introduction. And through the years, just listening to the stories, I mean, when you're a kid and your father tells you about times when he was like 13 and 14 years old in Detroit and in Chicago getting stranded and having to live off peanuts and Pepsi Cola, my thing was like, where can I sign up? I mean, I didn't see anything but glory in that. I was like, man, this is such a cool life. So I always wanted to be like that. I always wanted, it was like these stories he would tell me would become a movie in my mind. It's like, I'm going to do it. And I have been stranded a few times in places too. So, but we'll talk about that. I'll write the book and tell you about that.
So you had said he had kind of retired from performing, but he started performing again with you guys?
He just took a few gigs. And then later on when I had Lonnie in the band, I mean, Tyrone and all those guys can tell you, my dad would manage us. And when we would go on the road, he would go with us sometimes. And every now and then, he would just sit in with us. Uh-huh. And basically, I learned how to entertain. Because what he would do, I mean, you got this band that's playing funk. We're up there doing Parliament P-Funk and Coolin' the Gang and Hauling Oats and all this stuff. And we playing in these really rowdy kind of places. I mean, you know, it's not the kind of places, it wasn't Plaza 3.
Right.
So we playing at these places in the Chitlin' Circuit on the road in this rough and rowdy group. And then you got these young cats in their 20s and stuff like that. And then we got this old guy that we bring up to the bandstand. And my father would charm the audience. He'd have them laughing. He'd tell these stories and these jokes. And then he would ask us to play some. Now, we were a funk band, so my drummer, he used to stunk, pop, stunk, pop, stunk, dunk, stunk, pop, kadunk, stack, kadunk, kadunk, shack. And he starts something like that. My father would just hit. And everybody would lose, including me. I mean, I'd be like, what is he doing? And my father would go out there and just hit. After he would charm the audience, sing a little bit, and we would kind of try to back him up because we, you know, by us growing up from my father, we knew some of those kind of songs. We kind of knew them. Stuff like Route 66 and L is for the way, you know, and some old Nat King Cole songs my dad would sing. He sang one little song, and they would love it. These rowdy people would sit down and listen to this old dude, and then when he would tap dance, church was out.
Right.
I mean, so that was me basically learning from just watching him. He would just be able to charm the audience, and they liked him. After they liked him, he would show them, I know how to dance. And then it was over, man.
They were already rooting for him before he dropped anything. And then before once he could actually bring it,
that's it. That's
he
it,
was
kid.
A hero, yeah.
And that's how he would do it. And so that is always in the back of my mind. I am an entertainer. I use jazz as my chosen musical format, and I always try to keep it artistic. But I'm the kind of person, you know, a lot of purist artists will tell you, well, I'm not playing for the people. And I get it. I totally get it. I'm not, I don't judge anybody. I'm sure I get judged a lot. But I'm just who I am. I'm not selling out. And this is who I am. I grew up as an entertainer. I grew up listening to Marvin Gaye. So if I do a Marvin Gaye song, I'm not pandering. This is what I like.
Right.
And when I do something by John Coltrane, I'm not pandering. This is what I grew up listening to. This is honestly me being me. And it is a natural thing for me to be very humble and ingratiating to the audience. I do care that the audience has a good time. I'm not so into what I'm doing that I don't care. Now, when I hire musicians, it's like a part of a team. Now, their job is to bring the highest level of musical integrity that they can possibly bring. I'm the entertainer. I got that. When I hire a musician, I'm listening for a guy that I don't care if he even knows how to talk English to the people. That's not why I want him on the bandstand. I want him because he's the best piano player or bass player or drummer or saxophone player that I can possibly find. And I don't care about him being able to entertain. That's what I do. So I would very quickly say that my musicians, I would never hire a musician that can't play better than me. Put it like that.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you've got a touring funk band that your dad's managing.
Yep.
And your brother's in it.
Yep. Oh yeah.
And so it's a family organization in a lot of ways.
Kind of, sort of. It was a spinoff of where I started. You know. Okay, I guess I left a big gap. My first gig was at 6 years old, but I actually got serious at 16. That's when I got with a group called Clyde, Nim, and Her, which the Her in the band was Betty and Milt Abel's daughter, Betty Jo Miller. And so, and again, I'd known her since I was like maybe 4 or 5 years old. I mean, I remember going to Ike Witt's house. Again, this was Betty and Milt's best friend, who was our next door neighbor, and my dad. So all of them were friends, and they would have these parties at Ike's house. And I remember this one time in particular, they would be jamming, and then Ike said, "Hey, Jimmy, get the boys." So Ronald and I did this little tap dance, and for these, you know, over at, and then Betty and Milt played for BJ, Betty Jo Miller, to sing San Francisco. At the time, me and Ronald might have been 6 and 7, maybe she was 10 or 11. So we were these kids that were learning from our parents. And then later on, all of us kind of followed in our parents' footsteps, because Betty Jo was the Her of Clyde, Nim and Her, who at the time was easily the best cover slash funk R&B band in this part of the country. I mean, they were the one funk band that was featured on the jazz festival at the Municipal Auditorium at the same time when they had Maynard Ferguson. They had, I can't even call the names, but Clyde, Nim and Her were the ones that got the write-up.
Right, they'd bring in a lot of national acts for that. I remember those.
Yeah, that we used to have jazz festivals that were second to none. I mean, it was just like going to Montreal Jazz Festival, and that's that's when Clyde, Nim and Her made a name for themselves. They played on that, and everybody knew about them after that. And later on, I got with them at 16 years old. I said all that to say that was the first band I got with after they had to go through a transition because they had a lot of gigs booked and some of the guys in the band wanted to quit. And so Clyde put together a band that was supposed to just be to do these gigs for the next 2 months, and then he was going to move to California. What happened is the band started sounding good, and so he stuck with us, and I stayed with Clyde, Nim and Her for about a year and a half. Then I came back to Kansas City, and I started my band, Lonnie and the Band, and that's when my father started managing us.
Okay, all right. So then how long did you do that group with the...
Wow, we lasted for about 10 years. And again, all of us were in high school. And I'm going to be honest with you, man. We couldn't play in any of the major places here in Kansas City. That's when they had a lot of places back in the 80s and late 70s and 80s. And they had Seville Square back then, and they had bands that would play there, and they had a lot of places on the plaza. Back then, there were a lot of places to play, but there were no places other than the inner city that would hire an all-black band. Now, mind you, musicians, we don't see anything, but I grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood, so all the musicians with me were black. All of us went to high school together, and so we ended up being booked in Japan 4 months out of the year, and that's what sustained us. And because when we would be back here in Kansas City, we would be basically all we could play was in the inner city. And so we would play at places like the Inferno and 50 Yard Line, Flankers, AG's. And AG's didn't open till the people talk about the foundation. Well, this was a club out on the outskirts of Kansas that didn't really get popping till like 1 in the morning, and we'd play out there. And everybody that's listening to this that remembers those days, they any of my contemporaries that are black, they played at the same places. All of us were doing the same circuits around here. But our band, we were fortunate to get this this connection that we would go to Japan for 4 months at a time, and then we would make pretty decent money doing that. But other than that, we were struggling, man, you know. But we lasted for 10 years. And when the band did break up, it was Ronald's idea that we go back to where we started. And that was the rebirth of the McFadden Brothers. Mm-hmm. And our first gig, we were hired by Olita Adams. She had a program that it was, I think, a women's Rotary Club or something that featured her in her first album at the music hall. She wanted a dance act. And Curtis Pickering told her about Ronald and I. And what he didn't know is my band had broke up, but it worked out perfectly because she just wanted tap dancers. And Ronald and I had already started practicing putting our McFadden Brothers act together. And that was our introduction as the McFadden Brothers. We were a featured act on the Olita Adams Show at the Music Hall.
So, and the McFadden Brothers has been a going concern ever since.
Yeah, that has been what has kept me in entertainment. Actually, the McFadden Brothers, we did our first full-time gig at Worlds of Fun. I mean, I think of it now and I'm thinking, how did we, here's the scenario. We were playing at Worlds of Fun, 6 shows a day, 6 days a week from May to October. And that was our first full-time, and we loved it. I mean, I think of it now, and I'm thinking, how do? And back then, you might remember, Ken, because you've already teased me about coming to, back then, Ronald and I would be jumping off of 5-foot stages, doing the splits in the air, hit the ground, spin around, and I don't quite do all that now.
But you were doing how many shows a day doing that?
6 shows a day.
6 times a day.
6 shows a day, 6 days a week at Worlds of Fun. And we did an audition. They didn't have a spot for us, so they made a spot. They put this stage out in the middle of the street out there in Worlds of Fun. And they, Walter Bryan and some other musicians made a tape of our arrangements. And so we would play these 15-minute sets 6 times a day out at Worlds of Fun, out in the hot sun. And back then we had these magical canes that we pull out of. And we were show business to the, and we were hitting it, man. And I loved it. I loved every minute of it. After that, we got this lady that got us a gig down in St. Louis, and we did a show about, a guy wrote a play about my dad and his career. As I said, he was part of the Kansas City jazz scene, and it was interesting to this guy that Ronald and I were kind of following in his footsteps, and so he called it Steps, the Pops McFadden Story. We did that for a while, came back to Kansas City, and then we got booked. We started being booked by Count Basie Enterprises, which took us to all of the jazz festivals over in Europe. We were doing all-night jam sessions in all over France with people like George Benson, Wynton Marsalis, Branford Marsalis. I can't even call all the people. Arturo Sandoval, I met him the first time at the North Sea Jazz Festival. I met so many people, and we were being booked by them doing all these big gigs, and it was pretty awesome, man. We danced in front of the Count Basie Orchestra for the first time on 18th and Vine, and that still chokes me up a little because my dad was sick. He didn't get a chance to see us, and that was awesome to me that when we danced in front of the band, he had passed, but we danced in front of the Count Basie Orchestra for the first time in the middle of the street on 18th and Vine. And this is before the Jazz Museum and all that had opened up. And that's still an awesome moment for me when I think about it. They threw a piece of plywood out on 18th Street.
Nothing fancy.
Nothing fancy. Exactly. There you go. We've been rolling in high cotton for a long time.
But that's kind of came full circle. You know, that your dad had you know, worked with those guys back in the day when they were coming up in Kansas City, and then the Count Basie thing just became so legendary, and as he kind of reconnecting that band with its Kansas City roots, and there you guys are to make the connection.
And that was still when, and you might remember this, Ken, when Eddie Baker, I think, had passed or else he was getting sick, but he was one of the main people that was trying to get the National Jazz Museum here years ago. He had this plan like back in the 60s and 70s. He had letters from Dizzy Gillespie, from Count Basie, from all these great jazz musicians that had endorsed his idea. And he was the first one that came up with the concept for the National Jazz Museum to be here in Kansas City. And he never lived to see it happen. But I
remember being at gigs at Piccolo's with Marvin Hollenshead and having him tell me, the museum's going to be right here. It's going to be on this street.
Yeah,
you know?
That's it. Piccolo's. Wow, I haven't heard that name in a long time. Woo, woo, you took me back.
Well, when you were talking about 18th and Vine before, before the Jazz Museum.
Right.
You know, that was sort of that. I remember going to Piccolo's, would have been early 80s,
yeah,
mid 80s. And
that's
the 18th
right.
and Vine, you know, El Capitan.
That's right.
Was still across
that's
the street,
right.
You know,
right.
Where the museum store is now was El Capitan.
Wow.
And, you know, and it was a very different vibe down there that back
yeah,
then.
Yeah, you are absolutely right. Well, that's the vibe I grew up in, the one you're talking
right,
about now.
Right.
That was the tail end of it.
Right.
What you're talking about is the tail end of the vibe that I grew up in.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, God, Ken, you do know a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, I was doing those gigs, and we'd play also with Horace Washington, and Eddie Baker
yeah.
would be a lot of those gigs because they were friends.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to him about, you know, he was like, the Jazz Museum, we're going to have, it's going to be.
That's right.
And I think he had maybe a different, I can't remember the name he'd used for it, but it might have just been the Kansas City Jazz Museum or International.
I can't remember. International. So I think it was in, I can't remember it,
but,
either.
But yeah, he already had an idea where it
yeah.
would be. And
yeah, he had it all planned out, I mean, years ago. So, I mean, you know, the history of this city, and I'm very fortunate that I'm old enough to have met a lot of those guys, and I knew them. I mean, you talk about, you know, some of the guys that could really swing. I mean, Sonny Kenner, Eddie Saunders, Dahoud on bass. I mean, I don't think there's anybody on the planet that swung harder than those guys. Man, that was the Kansas City sound, and I was fortunate enough to get that engraved in me. I mean, I think I still sound like that now. No matter if I'm playing a Kool & the Gang song or if I'm playing a John Coltrane song, it's still some of that in what I do, and I embrace it.
Right.
I love it.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So let's play some music now, and we're going to hear El Monte Cristo. And this is available both on the Lonnie McFadden Live at Green Lady Lounge. It's also available on the Lonnie McFadden I Believe in Music CD.
Yeah, but I have to admit, the one I did on I Believe in Music, that's me trying to give the best interpretation of the way I'm hearing my songs in my head. I did them all on this keyboard. And then my friend Craig Lindsay, he helped me to make the instruments sound more realistic. But what DeAndre does on bass on this live at the Green Lake, I mean, it's no way. He does what I wish I could have done. And so when I think of the way that Andrew, DeAndre, and Tyree interpreted this song, I'm like, wow, they turned it into magic. So, again, I'm fortunate to be around greatness, man.
Awesome. Well, we will hear that live version featuring those fantastic musicians. And this is Lonnie McFadden live at Green Lady Lounge. And we're going to hear El Monte Cristo.
Thank you.
So far, we've heard two tracks with you playing trumpet, but that is only a small part of the entertainment package that you bring to any performance. And we're going to hear some vocals of yours of another song you've composed called Our First Date. It sounded like your dad got you singing the songs he sang, right?
Right.
Initially, that was sort of your beginning, you were singing. But what kind of has your journey been as a vocalist? Because that's... people find different way, you know, different paths to being a vocalist, you
right.
know?
Well, with me, it was like a lot of things with my music career, it was me trying to make a living. For instance, the way I started singing, I was with Clyde Neiman Herr, and it was this one song that he wanted me to sing, and I said, well, I don't want to do it. He said, well, if you want to be in the band, you'll sing. and that ended the conversation because I wanted to be in this band. And the first song that I sung was, I forget who it's by, but it's, I'm an ever-rolling wheel, ba-doom, without a destination real. Got me going in circles. Okay, that song. And I was so shy. I used to, you have to picture a 16-year-old kids standing up there with a big afro. I had my trumpet in my left hand. I would slump it over the mic and hold my trumpet, and I would bend my head down into the microphone, and I would sing. I was so shy. I had no problem
the
jumping
out. The
trumpet
was like your shield.
That was it. That was like, yes, yeah. And so I was so shy, I could not look into the audience. I had to close my eyes. And so that was when I started singing. It was painful, man. I didn't want to be a singer at all. And I never considered myself a singer. I think I took singing like this is something I have to do the job. And then what happened, again, I'm going to fast forward now to like the last 15 years. After me going through a few things in my personal life, you know, marriage, divorce, and things like that, and then realizing that I'm going to be a musician, win, lose, or draw. When I started playing again, I had one gig once every 2 weeks at this place called Vivace. It was down in the River Market area. It was cool, real cool place. But I was there once every other Thursday, and I started singing these R&B tunes. I hadn't done them in years, but I decided, you know, I'm an entertainer. I'm trying to play what people want to hear. And these are songs that I used to do when I was like 19, 20 and stuff like, so I knew
when
all
they,
of
when
them.
When they were new.
Yeah. Exactly. It's the truth though. And so it was like I got put in a position because it was just me and Mark Lowry down there. Mark got sick, and so I had to hire this somebody at the last minute. The only person I could hire was this bass player named Beaver, and he had all these songs that he had on tracks, so I had to do what he could do instead of, and that's been the course of my career. I mean, if we talk about a lot of things, what has helped me to learn a lot is I had to learn right now. I had to do it right now in order to do the gig. And right. So when Beaver came down to do this gig with me at Vivace, he had all of these tracks of all of these songs that I used to do like 30 years ago. And I said, okay, we'll do that. So I come in, they used to be doing Girl From Ipanema and all these jazz standards, me and Mark. And so I come in this night and I got all these songs on tracks with Beaver. Beaver's playing bass and we got the drums and everything, and I'm doing stuff like Me and Mrs. Jones and What's Going On by Marvin Gaye and The Temptations, My Girl, and all this. Now, mind you, I hadn't sung all these songs in like 30 years. I hadn't done any of this. The owner of the club, it got such a good response. People were dancing all night, and I'm cool with it. I mean, I like these songs anyway. He came to me at the end of the evening and said, this is what we want. We want this. And so that was the beginning. And I said all of that to say that for the first time, I started getting so many compliments as a singer. I never considered myself, I still don't consider myself to be a good singer. I feel like people enjoy what I do. So I've gotten enough confidence to at least do it now. But I'm very thankful that people like the way I sing, because it's not something that I grew up trying to be. I tried to be a trumpet player. I was drafted into being a tap dancer. And as a singer, it was something that I had to do if I wanted to do the job. And so the fact that people enjoy it is a blessing to me. I never thought I could be a pleasant sounding singer. So I'm glad. I'm glad.
It's impressive to me how many really some of my favorite vocalists have a similar story. You know, mm-hmm. Nat King Cole.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
He had to sing to keep the gig.
Exactly.
You know.
My story is exactly
Diana Krall.
Like that.
You know, she wanted to play like Bill Evans. That was her. You know, she wanted to play piano. You know, and she sang to get through a gig. Next thing you know, she's a big singing star. You know.
Well, I've not reached their level at all, but that my story is the same.
Right.
I did what I had to do to not get fired. And that's keeping it real as it gets, Ken. We having real conversation now. There's a vocal coach that comes to hear me every now and then, and out at Sullivan's on Sundays, and she has asked me to come to the school and I don't know how to do what I do. I can't teach it because I don't know. I would love, I just know I'm doing what works for me.
Right.
And I don't, you know, I would be the last one to teach somebody something the wrong way.
Right, so you never had a lot of formal training about how to sing.
Nobody ever told you to sing from
the diaphragm or anything.
Zero.
Just whatever naturally happened to produce a sound is what you got.
Sing the song, the next week I was singing it. And when Beaver came down to Vivace with those songs, I hadn't done them in 30 years, I said, yeah, let's do it. And that has evolved into me singing every night. And now it's a big part of what I do. With Ronald and I, as the McFadden brothers, again, it was like I was singing because that's what the songs required. The singing was a vehicle to get us to the part where we're going to tap dance.
Right. Right.
Or when we're going to play a solo on our horns. That's all the singing was to me. It was a vehicle to get us to have an opportunity to play or an opportunity to tap dance.
Right.
Now it's something I embrace because, again, I play for people and people enjoy it, so I'm in.
Right.
If people didn't enjoy it, I wouldn't do it.
Right.
I would never do it.
Well, let's hear this track. This is a song you wrote fairly recently.
Yeah. Yeah, I wrote this because, again, I'm not shy about the fact that I feel very fortunate that I found somebody that actually put up with me. And I was thinking about that one day, and that's when I wrote this song that basically talked about when I met the lady that I'm now married to. I think it's so awesome to have somebody in my life that doesn't mind being there. So,
well, excellent.
Life is good.
Very good. Well, let's hear Our First Date by Lonnie McFadden.